this is a great outcome for Bitcoin, but also a great outcome for the United States. I think we have some difficulty now in the country where we're politicizing everything. And I think the best regulators or the best practices for regulators is a depoliticization of a regulatory body. And so whether they're Democrats or Republicans, let's not look at it from a left or right perspective, but from a right or wrong perspective. Is this good for investors? Is it transparent? Is there clarity? And so on and so forth. And I think that we want that from our judicial system as well.
You're listening to Bite-Sized Business Law, where we discuss big issues in small doses. This podcast is sponsored by the Fordham University School of Law Corporate Law Center, which is run by Fordham Law Professor Richard Squire and me, your host, Amy Martella. Okay, let's get down to business.
Hey, welcome back to Bite-Sized Business Law. Today, we are so excited for the discussion about the recently approved Bitcoin ETFs, how that approval was won, what's happened since, and where Bitcoin is headed. There's literally no one better suited to walk us through this topic than today's guest, Anthony Scaramucci. Anthony is the founder and managing partner of SkyBridge Capital, an investment firm, and the founder of SALT, a financial think tank and forum. He's perhaps most well known for serving as President Trump's White House communications director, but has more lately been making a name for himself as one of the most influential voices in the crypto space. Anthony, welcome.
One of the most influential. That's a pretty big introduction.
Well, you are.
And you didn't mention I got fired from the White House because you're a very nice and generous person, although that was also a lot of fun. But anyway, I'm happy to be on, and it is a historic time for Bitcoin because there's a sea change of progression in Bitcoin. And so obviously the ETF is going to create way more demand for Bitcoin. And since your viewers and listeners probably know this, but I'll just repeat it, you know, Bitcoin's limited. It's capped at 21 million coins or tokens. And so many of those coins were lost in the inception of Bitcoin. So guys like Michael Saylor, who run a publicly traded company called MicroStrategy and owns several hundred thousand Bitcoins, believes that there's only probably 16 or 17 million coins left because coins got lost in people's iPads or they got lost in some old laptop or, believe it or not, somebody's BlackBerry back in the day. And so it makes it even more scarce at a time where there's lots of demand. So,
can you imagine the lucky fellow who finds an old laptop and has a bunch of Bitcoin on it?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. In fact, there's a very famous story where up in Connecticut, a gentleman threw his laptop out and he wanted to split the proceeds of what they found on the laptop with the town, if the town was willing to go into the landfill with him and dig up the landfill to see if they could find the laptop. But the town said, we're not doing that. So I'm pretty confident that laptop's gone forever. And on that hard drive is, according to him, several thousand Bitcoin, which is a big amount of money today.
Absolutely. All right. So before we get into the meat of Bitcoin, I wanted you to talk to our listeners a little bit about your own background. So people might not realize that you actually have a law degree from Harvard, but it doesn't sound like you practice law a day in your life. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I went to Tufts University and Harvard Law School. I think probably somewhat noteworthy to just talk a little bit about this. I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood. My dad was a crane operator. He spent 42 years at a construction company out on Long Island, and he was in the union. He was an hourly worker, but it was a time in America where union members like my dad were paid a decent amount of money, so we lived in the middle class. I would never dishonor my dad by saying I grew up poor. Did not grow up poor, and I went to a good public school. I ended up going to Tufts University, which was a steep ticket for my folks at the time. So I borrowed a lot of money to go there. Since you want a little bit of detail, I think it's worth mentioning this. My guidance counselor, may his soul rest in peace, was a guy named John Zanetti. And he was Italian. He came to my parents' kitchen table one night in 1981. He must have smoked 40 cigarettes and drank 15 double espressos. And he told my parents, listen, you can't send your son to the state school. He has an opportunity to get into a private school like Tufts University, and it'd just be a better career track for him. It'll open up more doors for him. And of course, the differential in expenses was quite high at the time. But that was a seminal moment for me because my parents you know, they didn't know any better. And of course, I didn't know any better, but they sent me to Tufts, and that was a good education for me. And it was down the block from Harvard Law School. And I do think that that also helped me get into Harvard. So I went to Harvard Law School, graduated in 1989. I was the underachiever in that era. Barack Obama was there, Neil Gorsuch. One guy became president, the other guy became a Supreme Court judge, and I didn't do as well as those guys, but it's been a great career. So I started at Goldman. I didn't practice law, and my mother was very sore about this. Of course, she didn't know what Goldman was, and so she lied to all of her friends and told them that I was working at a law firm. I was in Rosano's Deli in my local neighborhood. It was probably 1991, and Mrs. Capobianco turned to me and said, "Anthony, how is that law firm, Goldman and Sachs? How are you doing at that law firm?" I'm like, "Wait, my mother told you I'm working at a law firm?" She said, "Yes." So my mother was embarrassed. Okay.
Embarrassed of Goldman.
Yeah. She was embarrassed I didn't practice law. But I spent 7 years at Goldman. And then I left at the age of 32 to start my first business. I had a partner who was a great human being. He's now retired. He was a couple of years older than me. And we built a business called Oscar Capital Management. It was sort of a take on our two last names. His name was Bozart. Mine was Scaramucci. We dropped the B and took the first two syllables and called it Oscar. We did that for 5 years. We sold it successfully to a company called Neuberger Berman. Neuberger was then bought by Lehman Brothers. And I worked at Lehman Brothers for a short period of time while thinking about and eventually setting up SkyBridge. So SkyBridge is 19 years old. As you mentioned, some of my politics, I got into politics in the early 90s because I was a blue-collar kid and I didn't really have any connections in the wealthy individual space. And since I wasn't a member of a country club and never hit a golf ball or swung a tennis racket, one way to get into that sort of elite crowd was through the world of politics. And so I wrote my first check to a guy named Rudy Giuliani. I mean, this was before Rudy went nuts, but he was running for mayor. He lost the race in 89, but he won in 93. And so I had the opportunity to be one of his young fundraisers. I then worked for Governor Pataki. I've been a Republican fundraiser my whole career. And then I worked for George W. Bush. I ended up working for Mitt Romney. And of course, I was on the Jeb Bush campaign before he left the campaign. And then Mr. Trump asked me to join his campaign. And then I made the fateful step of accepting a job in the White House, which didn't work out that well for me. But, you know, the byproduct of that is he certainly did raise my profile. But I think this is an important part of the story. So I'm in the White House, and I can tell you this, Amy, it happened on a Wednesday. The reason I know that, I was only there for one Wednesday. So as most people know, I got fired after 11 days. But I was there on this Wednesday afternoon when two Fed officials came to the White House to talk about the white paper that they had written. This was a digitization of the U.S. dollar, or at least an idea about using the blockchain to digitize the U.S. dollar 7 years ago now. But I remember thinking, okay, wow, I don't know anything about the blockchain. My friends, the Winklevoss twins, have told me about this thing called Bitcoin. I don't know about it. I'm skeptical. I'm a traditional finance person. And so after I got fired from the White House, I went back to SkyBridge, which is the company that I own, and I bought the URL skybridgebitcoin.com. And I did a ton of homework on it. And then I made a decision to start buying Bitcoin in October, November of 2020. And so I was 3 months after Michael Saylor. Michael's the CEO of MicroStrategy, but he's a very good close personal friend of ours here at SkyBridge. And I think we drew the same conclusions about Bitcoin and the same idea that this was going to be something that was going to catch on. So just to fast forward, though, I had a great 2021 and my clients thought I was a genius. And then I had probably the worst year of my career, which was 2022. And my clients thought I was a dummy. And now 2023 was a good year, the early part of 2024. But coming out of 2022, SkyBridge made a decision. We got in bed with BlackRock, which is the largest asset manager in the world. Their team came to see us. They wanted to apply for a Bitcoin ETF. At that point, the market sentiment was very negative, and people thought, okay, they'll this will never happen. But the BlackRock guys were setting up a trust and they needed outside capital to go into this trust. And so they came to our team here. We gave them $10 million. So we were the first money in to the BlackRock Bitcoin Trust, which was recently converted last month into that ETF. So, you know, we're very proud of that. We're very proud of that relationship. And about, I would say, a third of the $3 billion in assets that we have here at SkyBridge is in the digital asset space, which would include Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, and a few other coins.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, I know you're known as one of the earliest Bitcoin cheerleaders. So you ran right home after the White House and snagged that URL, which was very, very smart. And thank you for sharing, by the way, your story, because we have a lot of listeners, a lot of our students are first generation lawyers, and it's a different path for sure than when you're born into a family of lawyers who, you know, went to law school and work at firms. So it's fascinating to hear a story like yours. Okay, so you got into Bitcoin early and your skin in the Bitcoin ETF game is that SkyBridge is heavily invested in the BlackRock Bitcoin ETF, as you just explained to us.
Yeah, we were the first money in there. We own a lot of coins sort of in our own cold storage wallet. We own some coins that we've got stored at places like Fidelity Digital Assets, as well as NYDIG. And then, of course, we own some of the BlackRock Bitcoin ETF. We also have a publicly traded company ETF that's a SkyBridge ETF. It's called CRPT, which is sort of crypt. It has some of the largest names in the Bitcoin ecosystem. And so anyway, make a long story short, we are big believers in the space, big believers long-term in the transformation of the space. And since you mentioned that you have perhaps first-generation students, I guess the thing I would say to you is be bold. You know, Virgil, the Roman poet who wrote the Aeneid, I think he started the poem with "the fortune favors the bold." It's obviously translated from Latin, but the idea is be bold, take risks with your career, be willing to follow and pursue your dreams. When I got to law school, and again, I'm just being very open with you, I didn't know a lot about the law. I went to law school because I thought it was a safe financial ticket for me. At that time, I think they were paying first-year associates at these large corporate law firms about $65,000 a year. I think my dad was making about $40,000 a year. I was like, wow, so I can leave law school and make more money than my parents, and maybe there'll be an upward slope from there. And so I went to law school with some primitive analytical thinking. I didn't really take a deep dive into the legal space. Now, by the way, I am an unbelievable beneficiary of a legal education. It's made me smarter. It's made me smarter in dealing with contracts and dealing with lawyers.
So you feel like, Anthony, you call upon your legal training even in what you do today?
Every minute of the day, I call upon my legal training. And so if you're going into business and you're a law school student listening to this, you're going to be a direct beneficiary of your legal training. If you're going into the law, obviously, you need this legal training. But I think that the most valuable thing I learned in law school, which I apply literally every day, is the duality of thinking. I think we have to, in our minds, especially in the tribalism that's going on and sort of the social media vortex that we're all living in now, you have to take two compelling ideas that are opposed to each other, and you have to be able to hold them in your mind simultaneously and think about both sides of a story and analyze the other side as good as, if not better, than your own point of view. And I also think that my legal training has made me personally a lot more flexible. I feel like I have more neuroplasticity as a result of my law school training. I find a lot of people that are in my industry, they get sort of closed-minded on certain things, particularly people my age. I turned 60 this year, and I can tell you that I have 60-year-old friends that would never own Bitcoin, and they've missed something, which I think is historic. And I think it's still early for Bitcoin, I might add. But I think what ends up happening is if you lose that flexibility in terms of broadening your thinking or making an adaptation to your thinking, you could miss lots of opportunities. And I think a legal training provides that to somebody. So
Yeah, you're a testament to that because it's so rare to see someone in politics say, you know what? I saw some evidence, X, Y, and Z, and I'm changing my mind.
Well, they're fearful. They're fearful. They feel like they've got a lane to drive in politics. It's true in the media. You know, I have friends of mine that are radio hosts or they're conservative talk show or TV hosts for that matter. And they may not even believe some of the things that they're saying, but they have to stay in that lane so that they can garner either that political support if they're a politician or that rating support if they're a radio person or a TV person. And I think that there's something lost in that intellectually. I think we have to be more broad-minded. There's a very famous quote from John Maynard Keynes back in the day when they were accusing him of flip-flopping. And he said, well, you know, when the facts change or I'm apprised of the facts differently, the wisest among us are willing and confident enough to change their point of view. And so I think a legal training provides that, by the way. I think you can look at things very objectively. And you also, if you're going to particularly provide some level of advocacy towards your position as a trial attorney or even as a corporate attorney, you certainly have to understand the other side of in a negotiation or in a potential litigation. And I think this has proven to be very valuable to me as it relates to analyzing investments.
Okay, so speaking about understanding both sides of an argument, I wanted to get your reaction to the DC Circuit's opinion this year, which, I mean, I can guess what it was, but just to give our listeners a little background, tell us about the ETF struggle. So the SEC for 10 years had kind of resisted allowing investors to access Bitcoin via like a typically regulated instrument. And then this year, the DC Circuit Court overturned the SEC's position on that. So tell us a little bit about that opinion and your reaction to it.
Well, I mean, I want to be as balanced as possible. I think that let's just talk about the SEC's point of view for a second. I think the SEC is influenced primarily about investor protection. And I think the SEC wants people to not get caught up in frauds or in some type of illicit schemes. And I think, unfortunately, when you have new technologies or you have the introduction of new ideas like this, you do induct a lot of maniacs into the situation. And so very famously, Sam Bankman-Fried, he went to trial, was convicted of fraud. He's awaiting sentencing this coming March. You have Celsius or Three Arrows and other entities that were either overlevered or they overpromised people, or in some cases, they committed fraud or broke their investment contracts. And so I think it creates heightened political scrutiny about Web3 and about Bitcoin in general. And so I think in fairness to the SEC, just to give their point of view, I think they're very, very nervous about having investors, particularly small investors, come in and get ripped off by people. And so they've been very, very slow to approve certain things related to Bitcoin or other Web3 technologies. Now, a flip side of that, however, is that there are large companies like a BlackRock or you can pick Fidelity as an example, or guys in the asset management space for multiple decades that are well regulated and are consistently doing the right things with regulators, that would make a case. Grayscale made the case that they were operating inside the guidelines of what the regulations required. And I think there's a piece of administrative law, you perhaps know this better than me, but there's code that basically says that a regulator cannot be arbitrary and capricious as it relates to the administration of that regulation. And so the U.S., this is one of the beauties of the U.S., and I think this is something that you guys are teaching at Fordham that needs to be emphasized over and over, is that the United States is the direct beneficiary of this legal framework. It's a direct beneficiary of all this common law precedent, and it's a direct beneficiary of the separation of powers clause of the U.S. Constitution. And we have that for the states as well. We have this separate but equal branches of government, which allows us never to have one person become an autocrat or one person to become a czar or an administrative czar or a regulatory czar. And I think what happened here is that the SEC probably overstepped, made this very political, and made a decision, no way ever are we going to let a Bitcoin ETF exist in the United States. Now, These Bitcoin ETFs have existed in Europe. They also exist in Canada. But there was a decision made that they weren't allowed to exist in the United States. The trouble with that, though, is that back in November of 2021, they approved Bitcoin futures. And so the case that was brought to the court was, well, it's almost identical. The cash ETF for Bitcoin is almost identical to the futures ETF. And the brief that the Grayscale attorneys wrote, I think, was pristine. And if you have a real interest in this, I would encourage people to just go to their website. You can read, it's been made public, and the brief was pristine. You could also read the response brief from the SEC, which I think lacked clarity, frankly. And you could feel some of the politicization commentary in that brief. And I think the court basically said that the SEC was acting in an arbitrary and capricious way related to not approving the ETF. And so Gary Gensler and his team lost that court case. They did, of course, have an opportunity to appeal that case to the Supreme Court, but they let that deadline pass. And so once they let that deadline pass, it became clear to us that they were going to improve the ETF. Others said that they wouldn't do it. But I think in Mr. Gensler's interviews post-approval, I think he made it clear that he lost the court case and therefore he was going to abide by what the court said to do. I think what I would say to you is that this is a great outcome for Bitcoin, but also a great outcome for the United States. I think we have some difficulty now in the country where we're politicizing everything. And I think the best regulators or the best practices for regulators is a depoliticization of a regulatory body. And so whether they're Democrats or Republicans, let's not look at it from a left or right perspective, but from a right or wrong perspective. Is this good for investors? Is it transparent? Is there clarity? And so on and so forth. And I think that we want that from our judicial system as well.
Yeah, so you see this as an example, Anthony, of like an administrative agency making a decision that maybe wasn't wise, and then the judicial branch stepping in to check them and say, you know, we're not passing on Bitcoin, we're not judging on that, but we're saying that the SEC has to treat like cases alike, and they did not do that here. So Gensler had a couple of choices. It wasn't like the necessary next step was not to approve the Bitcoin ETF. He could have gone back and given a more robust explanation for treating these products differently, but he didn't. And he has publicly stated that he felt that they forced his hand, and that's why he decided to approve the Bitcoin ETF. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I do think about it. I think that is correct. I think that's a fair assessment. I think, you know, frankly, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren from Massachusetts, who's supposedly for the unbanked and is supposedly a progressive, has decided that she dislikes Bitcoin. And I guess what I would say there, I want to be fair and measured in my remarks. I guess what I would say is that she hasn't done enough homework, because what I would suggest to everybody listening to this, go down the rabbit hole and research Bitcoin. And I don't know anybody that comes back up from the rabbit hole after doing a deep dive research into Bitcoin and doesn't like it or doesn't move towards Bitcoin. It seems to be a one-way direction in terms of the analytics, a one-way direction. And so very smart people like Stan Druckenmiller or Ray Dalio or Paul Tudor Jones, as they analyze Bitcoin, they realize that there was something there, that the digitization of value storage and being able to keep a ledger that's totally distributed and totally transparent would be a part of our future. It would also help us in a trustless society create trust without permission. And I think that's big steps for technology. And so, and again, I don't want to get into the macro discussion unless you want to about fiat currencies and the corruptive forces and the corruptive nature of what we do, what our governments do and politicians do in terms of inflation rates, not only here in the United States, which frankly are quite mild, although we had some inflation recently, it's been generally mild, but just around the world, it's been very corruptive. And I think that this type of technology tightens that up. It sort of, it takes it out of the hands of central bankers and politicians. So for those reasons, it's very favorable, but people like Elizabeth Warren don't like it. They've made a decision that they don't like it. They have acolytes like Gary Gensler. And so they're beating a political drum. And this drum is, we don't like Bitcoin. we can't really explain to you why we don't like it, but we don't like it. And so as a result of which we're making a political statement, and we want to inject that political statement and the politics of it into the regulatory process. And so courts rejected that, thankfully. And I think that's what the courts are there for, provide a check and balance on sometimes human behavior that runs amok.
So you're saying, Anthony, now Gensler and Warren, they're very smart public servants. You don't really believe that. It's not that they don't have the investor's best interest in mind. You just are saying that they don't know enough about Bitcoin and its potential.
Well, Gensler does. I mean, Gensler taught a course at MIT. There's 24 recorded hours of him speaking about the blockchain and Bitcoin. And I think if you got him unplugged and you asked him about this technology, he would have to accept, yes, this technology is here to stay. And he has been quoted now saying that Bitcoin is a commodity, which, of course, it has to be a commodity to get its own ETF. And so I think Gensler does understand it and probably secretly likes it, but he has political ambitions and sees himself as Secretary of Treasury in a Democratic administration, and he'll need Elizabeth Warren's support. And so he's following her lead to be negative on Bitcoin. But I think she clearly does not understand it. Again, you're asking me my opinion, I'll share it with you. I don't think she understands it at all. And I think she doesn't like the fact that people have gotten wealthy from it. And so that creates some anger in her, which I think is misguided.
So obviously, the DC Circuit Court opinion and the resulting approval of the Bitcoin's ETF was a huge win for Bitcoin. But there's, of course, been pushback. I'm wondering if the response to the pushback generally follows that same line, you know, the same idea that you just put forth, which it's just people who don't truly understand crypto. And so, for example, one, you know, there's a huge constituency that are very fearful that this move is going to like light a fuse of a crypto boom, which will inevitably lead to a crash, right? Because they think crypto is a breeding ground for crime and terrorism and sanction evasion and AML risk. Is that, again, just people who are misunderstanding it?
So, again, I'm not saying that it's not used for those things like tax evasion or crimes. It can be used for that. I think Mike Morrell, the former CIA director, wrote a white paper 2 years ago explaining that it's not a great use because what ends up happening is it's so transparent and the ledger is so transparent between wallet transfers that it's easy for the FBI or the CIA or Interpol to track this stuff. And so, you know, what we found is maybe $33 million was done on Bitcoin versus $900 billion was done with fiat currency or just traipsing suitcases of cash around the world as a form of illegal activity or in terms of transfer of value to each other. But yes, it can be used for that. But I think that again, is a political statement because it's way more exaggerated in terms of the propensity to use that. In fact, if anything, you would use the US dollar first before you would use Bitcoin because it's just easier, frankly, to use. So I think that that's an easy thing to negate. I think the boom bust thing is real. I think we have to address that. I think that there's boom bust cycles, but here's the problem with that. Every time we have innovation in a global society, every time we have innovation technologically, we have a boom bust cycle. And we can go back to the telecom, we can go back to the railroads. If you want to go even further back, where there was a boom bust cycle in the railroads, there was fraud. You had Jay Gould manufacturing double share certificates and sending them out to people, total fraud. You had a boom bust cycle in Web 1. I'm old enough, unfortunately, to remember the crash in March of 2000, where the NASDAQ dropped 80%+, and it was a full-on annihilation of the web, and people thought Amazon was going out of business, and Microsoft crashed alongside of these other companies. And if you had the patience and fortitude to stay in there, obviously you did very well. But there's a boom-bust cycle. There's going to be potentially another boom-bust cycle in the web. I mean, Web 3, I should say, three or four of them since Bitcoin got started. There will probably be a boom bust cycle in AI. It's booming right now. It'll probably correct. But here's the problem. That is human nature. And that is the way things happen in our societies. We're very cyclical. I mean, I don't want to get so esoteric or overly philosophical, but we have four seasons. We have the moon phasing in and out of fullness. This is just the nature of things on the planet. And so I guess the real question is, how much do we want the government to interrupt that? I think we have to tell people, if you're buying this stuff, you want to use, for now, small amounts of capital if you're worried about the volatility. If you're not worried about the volatility, just buy it. Don't look at it for 5 years. Because, Amy, what we have found, and you could Google this somewhere, the dead people, they found out that at Charles Schwab, that the dead people's accounts, they seem to do way better than the people that are living. Okay. And so if the person dies, the account goes into neglect, and then they analyze the account. And guess what? Turns out that it does way better
over the long run
living, because guess what? Dead people don't look at their accounts. And so they sit there. You know, I have a very fun story I'll share with you. I bought $1,200 worth of Microsoft when I was at Goldman Sachs in the early 90s. And so I was 27 years old. I bought $1,200 worth of Microsoft for my son. This is when we had paper accounting, and so we got statements mailed to your home before we all went wireless and had apps and this sort of thing. And the account got misplaced. And so I didn't realize I had it. Goldman Sachs was sending the account statement to an address that I had moved away from long ago. It wasn't getting forwarded to me. And about 3 years ago, after 28 years of having that account open at Goldman Sachs, the $1,200 went to $71,000. And so you say to yourself, whoa, I would have probably sold that stock 5 or 6 times.
Of course.
Over that period of time. And so, you know, it's a great investment. I wish obviously now I had put more in it and had waited longer. But my point being is that if you're willing to wait and you're patient, I think you do very, very well. But if you're going to ride the cycles and get emotionally tangled up with this stuff, you are going to be subject to that. And I guess the real question is, how much interference do we want from the government in terms of providing that guidance? I think we have to tell people this. There's a sort of a Surgeon General's warning label on the investment. Here's the warning of the investment, and take it from there.
Yes, see what I mean? Transparent about the product.
Exactly. I don't necessarily want people to, you know, be nannied by the government.
Yeah. So just give us a few minutes looking ahead. First of all, how's Bitcoin done since the ETF approval?
Okay, so that's a good question. I actually don't know the answer to that. I'm going to guess at that. Bitcoin's up about 15% on the year, and I think the approval came on January the 8th. It actually went down a little bit after the approval because there was a lot of sales coming out of Grayscale, which was a high fee-based fund, and people were taking advantage of the taxability, taking tax losses there. I think that's stabilized now. I'm going to say it's up probably like 15 or 20%. But I do think it could go higher. And I'm not going to make predictions on this podcast, but I do think Bitcoin is an asset that could trade to, it may take a decade, but it could trade to the market capitalization of gold. Bitcoin right now is sort of a $900 billion market capitalization. Gold is a $14 or $15 trillion market capitalization. And I think if people are patient and they want to hold Bitcoin, they'll be rewarded, but they got to stay patient because it is a volatile asset.
Wow. Okay. So, and do you think other coins will get ETFs?
So I'm a skeptic on that. So I think that the SEC is making statements that Ethereum is a security. And so to understand the ETF rules, you can't put one security in an ETF. And so if Ethereum is deemed to be a security, then this May deadline for an ETF.
So what's the May deadline? Tell our listeners about that.
Okay. So basically applications have been put in to the SEC. The regulatory guidelines are such that the SEC can't just sit on something. They have to make a decision. They have to opine on it. And so there's a regulatory guideline, I think it's mid to late May, where the SEC has to say yay or nay on the Ethereum application. But they're sending out statements that they believe that Ethereum is a security. Now, the trouble with that, and since this is a law school forum, it's worth noting, the trouble with that is that there's another token called Ripple, And Ripple had another lawsuit, another famous case in crypto versus the SEC. And Ripple won that lawsuit. Now, what was the lawsuit? Is Ripple a security or not a security? And so the judge ruled that it wasn't a security. Upon appeal, Judge Rakoff said it had elements of a security. And so now we've got to wait for another appellate court to opine one way or another. But, you know, the lower court's opinion is more or less stood. And so I think there's some sturdiness and I think there's some stable ground to suggest that Ethereum isn't a security and is in fact a commodity. And so we'll have to see what happens. But I think that the SEC could lose that court case. If they reject the Ethereum ETF, which they could, there'll be another lawsuit similar to the Grayscale case. And I would suspect that the SEC would probably lose that. So, you know, the direct answer to your question is, we'll eventually get it. I believe that, but we won't probably get it as quickly as the industry wants. I don't think it happens in May, but I think after a few lawsuits and lots of delays, it could happen maybe by mid-2025.
Yeah, Gensler's been careful to say just because we approved the Bitcoin ETFs, you know.
Yeah, he doesn't like losing, but he's losing a lot of cases. And the reason he's losing the cases, in my opinion, is that he's overly politicized the process. Instead of looking at the process and applying a objective and apolitical fairness to the process, he's decided to make it political. And that's why he's losing these cases in the court.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like their decision, though, for the Bitcoin ETFs really ushered in this feeling of safety for digital assets. So like the next very ambitious SEC commissioner who might want to like restrict these policies, now you're not just going to hear back from the crypto nerds, you're going to hear back from some of the world's largest asset managers like BlackRock.
That's correct.
So it'll be interesting. So just quickly tell us, you mentioned abroad, you mentioned Canada before Europe. What's happening with Bitcoin ETFs abroad?
Well, they're proliferating. So, you know, you have several of them in Europe. You have several of them in Canada. The Hong Kong government has been given a green light from the mainland. We think there'll be ETF, Bitcoin ETFs, cash or spot Bitcoin ETFs approved in Hong Kong in the next 90 or so days. I think is, you know, I think it's a big statement. And I'll frame it this way. If you really studied the regulatory process around Uber, none of the regulators wanted Uber. But Uber won out because the people wanted Uber. And so there was nothing the regulators could do to stop it. And I think this is going to be true for the Chinese government or the Indian government. People want this technology. And so I would ask your viewers and listeners to not think in an American-centric way, where we have by and large had a fairly stable currency over the course of our civilization, by and large. We've had inflation, but it's considered the world's leading currency or the world's reserve currency. But think of countries in Africa, Latin America, and parts of the world where the currencies have been butchered by the politicians or the central banking community, where there's rampant inflation. And this may be a good way to store value as opposed to putting it in a currency that's, you're losing 10 to 20% of the value every year.
Yeah, when you look at it that way, you're right. I mean, this would be extremely beneficial for certain parts of the world. Well, Anthony, thank you so much. I know I learned a lot in this really informative discussion, and it's a fascinating conversation. I'm sure our listeners will learn a lot as well. Thanks for your time. It was great speaking with you.
Well, listen, it's great to be on with you, and I wish you the best of luck with it.
Thanks to everyone at Fordham Law School, especially the Dean's Office and our Corporate Law Center donors for supporting this podcast. Bite-Sized Business Law is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Bite-Sized Business Law on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The information in this podcast is for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal advice, nor is it intended to promote the organizations with which our guests are affiliated. For more information, check out our show notes, and thanks for listening.